This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Go Extinct Faster edition. It's Wednesday, June 15th, 2022. On today's show, Jurassic World Dominion is the latest in the blockbuster reboot. In this one, dinosaurs now roam the world all too freely. It stars Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard, and various others from the very, very, very original, now de-extincted Jurassic Park. And then Jane Austen gets a wild and altogether, I think, lovely update in Fire Island. The movie was written by and stars Joel Kim Booster as Noah, or our Elizabeth Bennet. We'll be joined by Vulture's E. Alex Jung for that segment. And finally, does everyone marry the wrong person? So argues a New York Times opinion piece we will discuss. Joining me today is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hi there.
All right, shall we dig in? Let's do this.
Ready.
De-extinct dinosaurs have been unleashed into the wild. Their wild, that is, which is our world. That's the premise of Jurassic World Dominion. We have various raptors nesting on our skyscrapers and sores of one kind or another foraging through our refuse. It's a pretty great setup. Atop this setup, we get an evil plot to corner the world's food supplies by a company that's sort of a cross between Apple and Monsanto. We also get the de-extinction of Sam Neill and Laura Dern and Jeff Goldblum. This one is like the first predecessor in the new trilogy. It's directed by Colin Trevorrow. It stars Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard. Let's listen to a clip. Now, as with a lot of these gigantic blockbuster event movies, we don't really get to choose clips. We do get the trailer. We're going to play a piece of it. In this piece, you'll hear the voices of Laura Dern, Sam Neill, and Jeff Goldblum, all of whom were in the original Jurassic Park movies, and they're back.
Humans and dinosaurs can't coexist. We created an ecological disaster.
Ally Sattler.
Alan Grant.
You didn't come out all this way just to catch up now, did you?
You coming or what?
We're racing toward the extinction of our species. We not only lack dominion over nature, we're subordinate to it.
Okay, Dana, I'm going to start with you. Humans and dinosaurs, can they coexist in a giant blockbuster movie? What do you think?
Oh, my God. Okay, let me just start off by saying, Julia, I deeply resent that you forced us to watch this after I escaped the bullet of not having to review this movie. This is so bad. I refuse to accept if either of you has any positive feelings about this movie.
That is
it will
quite
permanently
the
alter my opinion it. Of your opinion. And I will, but I should also say, going into it, that I mean, I don't have a big connection to this franchise in the first place. Even the Spielberg original, which, you know, I saw much far, far after it came out, it's not a movie I feel a deep emotional connection to, although I understand why it made the splash that it did. But this second trilogy, to me, is almost like the second Star Wars trilogy in terms of how much it betrays whatever there was good about the original franchise. The director of this third installment, Colin Trevorrow, was also the director of the first installment of the World, you know, follow-up movies. And I believe he wrote or co-wrote the middle chapter as well. So he's been, you know, one of the forming minds behind this whole reanimation of the franchise. And I'm sorry, but he is just not a skilled filmmaker. There are movies that are long and feel sort of roomy because of it. I was thinking of The Batman in particular, a recent blockbuster we all saw that we liked with reservations and all agreed was probably 20 minutes too long. There's a difference between being roomy and needing some trims and then the vast airplane hangar of boredom that is Jurassic World Dominion, in which I consulted my watch about every half an hour thinking it can't possibly go on. And by the end, I was just in that state of despair, like I will never have any experience in my life again that is not watching Jurassic World Dominion.
I gotta say, Dana, tell us what you really think. Stevens is the very best Dana.
I mean, I should say that even as somebody who kind of missed the boat on the first Jurassic Park movies, I get what was wonderful about them. And it was this sense of wonderment, right? Which was expressed by all of those original actors in the first movie who are back for this one, Laura Dern, Sam Neill, and Jeff Goldblum, and this sense of kind of excitement about the future, which is then, you know, disappointed by the kind of awful, cynical realization that there's this company exploiting the dinosaurs. This movie doesn't seem curious or excited about dinosaurs. In fact, there was a great review I read. I believe this was in Paste magazine, where the critic said something like, if I had a child I hated who loved dinosaurs, I would take them to this movie because they would lose all their joy that they feel about this long ago, you know, lost world.
I totally enjoyed it.
Oh my God.
I mean, I can't say I enjoyed it because I will make any straight-faced argument that it's good. But first of all, the movie's worth watching alone for Laura Dern's costumes.
The sleeveless coat. Ellie, I thought of you, Julia, the long sleeveless blue belted coat.
100% would wear everything in the movie. Like the sumptuous, it's like Eileen Fisher plus like sumptuous fabrics, amazing jewel tone colors. Like I don't know exactly what kind of loot she's bringing down as a genetic scientist at her university, but that was a beautiful wardrobe, very sumptuous science lady clothes. It's like it was like the science lady version of the chic art teacher auntie outfit, I think.
Well, it's also anyway. A great example of layering, because if I understand it right, although this is very incoherently directed, so it's hard to tell, but I think this movie all takes place in basically one day and night, right? So she has to have this outfit that moves from, you know, around the world and through these incredible, you know, prehistoric environments and, you know, leaping onto helicopters or whatever, and she keeps shedding layers and having yet another chic thing underneath. Okay, we're done with Laura Dern's
wardrobe. That final, like, slub jersey tee and her little antique locket, it works. Every single layer works. It's just like sifting back through the sands of time. But it's just it's just an interesting document of what we require in terms of character and performance in terms of our blockbuster stars at this point. And Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard. And I've really loved Chris Pratt and things. I'm not sure I've loved Bryce Dallas Howard in anything particularly, although I'm sure she's been good in things and I just haven't seen them. He certainly can perform, right? He can be really funny. I thought he carried Guardians of the Galaxy through like his particular personality and charisma in a specific way. But this franchise, the reboot of it, seems to have required, you know, just not that much character or performance. And meanwhile, right, Jeff Goldblum shows up and like wiggles his finger and wears transition lenses. Again, the costuming throughout is really good. See it for the costumes.
Right. Oh, but Julia, these performers you're mentioning that are so good are barely in it. I mean, Jeff Goldblum seems like he jetted in for one day to film a couple of scenes.
And yet, I agree. He's, for the minutes that he's on screen, actually introduces characterization, degree of at least subtlety or at least some layer just below the sort of jazzy surface. You know, and suddenly it feels almost like a movie, but you know, a couple things. One is I totally agree that there seems to have been a kind of active self-deadening on the part of Chris Pratt in order to get his personality to fit into the stupidity of the script, the flatness and stupidity of the script. At moments, he seemed to me to be doing a George W. Bush impression. It just is so awful. And, you know, I will say that I never liked this franchise going all the way back to the supposedly nostalgia-inducing original, in part because Michael Crichton was just a fabulous cynic, and it was constructed like something genetically engineered to please the most maximum number of people in a commercial setting. I mean, it's just like, you know, and then this tiny patina of satire to redeem it. But at the end of the day, it's Spielberg, you know, taking populist material to its maximum potential in the original. I mean, you know, they're just, you know, I mean, does no one understand that if you put a camera on a glass of water and you haven't seen the dinosaurs yet? I mean, the lesson that Spielberg taught the world in Jaws is don't show the shark. Don't show the shark. There's no shark. What shark? And you just build and build and build. And the same thing in that moment, he's got that little glass of water on the dashboard that starts to vibrate with the very distant footsteps of the dinosaur. And that's your first inkling, not only that they exist, but how freaking big they are and what their relationship to the Earth is. And, you know, that's filmmaking, right? This is anti-filmmaking. There was a moment when I thought, I actually want to do the math on how many stupid things there are per beat in this movie. You know, and Dana, I have to say, I'm shocked to discover that this movie takes place in roughly 24 hours because it exhibits literally none of the virtues of unity of time or place.
That's what I mean. It's incoherently directed. Yes. It's not just that it's not good or boring or something. It's almost like there's not a meaningful temporal or spatial relationship between any of the multiple locations. Yeah. You know, it just has a very kind of madly expensive and yet filmed in, you know, 24 hours kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Well, the other issue is that with your point about not showing the dinosaurs, Steve, is they show so many dinosaurs all the time. Yeah. And the promise of the trailer and a potential appeal of this movie, right, is to be Rise of the Planet of the Apes of the dinosaurs. Like the end of the last one was all the dinosaurs get free. And, you know, the challenge in the, you know, the challenge for the franchise is you cannot then make it a horror movie where the dinosaurs are free and the human heroes are fighting the dinosaurs, right? Because fundamentally the dinosaurs are like cute and a source of wonderment. And yes, they're dangerous, but it's our fault. You know, like you can't make the dinosaurs the villain. So the dinosaurs have to kind of be the heroes, or at least like for whatever reason, they couldn't follow the logic through of like, no, there just are dinosaurs everywhere. And all the scenes are the, you know, the pterodactyls nesting on top of the Freedom Tower. I don't know if the pterodactyls are raptors, Steve. I feel like raptors are more ground-based, but I could be wrong.
Sorry.
But I wanted more raptors charging through the alleyways of Malta, and fewer scenes where a Bigfoot showed up in the forest and then someone just like rattled off a series of facts about how big the dinosaur was. Like, that's a dreadnought of something or something. Oh, that's the Allosaurus. Oh, they shouldn't have put so many alphas in this valley. And then the movie seems to think that we care about which of the fictional computer blobs wins a fight. Like a whole 10 minutes of the final sequence is just like the various fake monsters fighting. And it reminded me of, I know two people who were PAs on Michael Bay's latest Transformers movie recently on the set of shoots that was just like machines fighting on a bridge. Like it was like a sub shoot that had no actors because it was just all going to be CGI. And I was like, oh, this is that. Like the part, like somehow we've got by the end of the movie, because it's so scarecrow stitched together, we've got like nine characters, and I came out of it almost wanting to like play Jurassic Park. Like the whole last half hour is just the nine characters running around in the dark, and then they have almost like a dance move where like something big comes their way and they get into like a phalanx where you can see all of them in their outfits and they stare up at the thing.
Screaming.
They, like, they scream, or then they just like look quietly and like hope it won't notice them. And then they like scamper around behind the nearest overturned tank and then like assemble into their little dance phalanx again. Like, and they just keep adding people into the thing. It's like the family picture. They keep, oh, it's like, oh, your boyfriend's home for Thanksgiving. I'll get him in the picture too. Come on, come on. Just, it's so unwieldy. So they're doing that for like 20 minutes. And then they're just like, and which of the big apex predators in this fictional valley is going to win? And then we just watch like three dark blobs stab each other with variously shaped claws. I don't know. I just thought it was hilarious.
There's even a moment in one of those late dino fights where one of, I think it's Chris Pratt, somebody in the phalanx of people says, come on, this isn't about us. And then they run off to whatever their getaway vehicle is. And it's sort of like, well, why isn't it about you? It's your movie. The screenwriter could have made it about you. It is not inevitable that we have to watch a CGI dinosaur fight.
Julia, I just want to double back. One point I really take is like they turn them into raccoons. They turn them into deer. You know, they're like pests. They're riffling through your freaking recycling and garbage. It just, you know, and of course they don't go for any humor at all. The whole thing is just po-faced nonsense.
Can I make a point about that, though, about the presupposed world? I mean, the setup in the first 10 minutes or so seemed like it could have had some intriguing connections to, yes, for example, climate change, right?
Yes.
I mean, COVID, the reality of this world that we're living in, where there's sort of horrible things that we just live with and tolerate. And the idea that, you know, we're some number of years out from the last movie and that dinosaurs are now just in the world as almost like pests could have been a really interesting setup for some, you know, social critique, social satire, some kind of allegory. And the movie completely abandons that by having everybody pretty soon converge on this, you know, enclosure where the dinosaurs are, where we're just on another island with no stakes, right? I mean, it's throwing away everything that could have set the movie apart and made it interesting. It's like an anti-smart movie.
Okay, well, on that note, it's the new Jurassic Park movie. It's got Dominion in the title. It's only in theaters. It made a bundle of money. Julia loved it. If you have an opinion about it, we'd love to hear it. Shoot us an email. Okay, moving on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk business. And Dana, what do we got?
Steve, we actually have three items of business today. It's a packed week at the Slate Culture Gabfest. First of all, an announcement about an upcoming live event with Slate. If you want to get up to date on everything that's happening with the Supreme Court right now, and that is a lot of things, many of them very disturbing, please come to the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York on Thursday, June 23rd. A lot of Slate's best writers about the judicial system and the courts, including Dahlia Lithwick, Mark Joseph Stern, Christina Cattarucci. The host will be Susan Matthews of the Slow Burn Roe v. Wade season that just started. Emily Bazelon. A lot of Slate old-timers and bigwigs will be at the Bell House unpacking all the Supreme Court news, and there'll also be a special live taping of the great podcast Slow Burn with the new season that just started about Roe v. Wade and the history of abortion rights in the U.S. Go to slate.com/supreme to get your tickets for this event at the Bell House. That's slate.com/supreme. Our second item of business is to remind listeners about the upcoming Summer Strut episode. This is our annual tradition here, begun by Julia Turner, where we ask listeners to send us their favorite summer songs, preferably something you can strut down the street to with it in your headphones. We compile all these into a Spotify playlist, and then after listening to it for a couple months, we choose our favorites and talk about them during a special episode later in the summer with Slate's great music writer, Chris Malanfi. So please, if you have suggestions for the list this year, email us at culturefest@slate.com with the subject line Summer Strut. That way we know where to put it in the pile and put it in the Spotify list. And remember to include the name of the song and the artist in the body of the email. We are really excited to listen to these, so please get the list bulked up for us. Our final item of business, Steve, is just to tell everyone about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're going to talk about an online debate that was flaring last week around the movie Fire Island, which we, of course, are discussing this week, after someone online accused the movie of failing the Bechdel test. Of course, many other people chimed in and said the Bechdel test shouldn't apply. The Bechdel test is nonsense. All kinds of arguments about the test itself. We thought that we would discuss the usefulness of the Bechdel test, quote unquote, which we'll talk about what that is, whether you're applying it to Fire Island or any other movie, TV show, book, etc. So if you're a Slate Plus member, you will hear that later in the show. And if you are not, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus segments like the one I just described, and lots of other shows have those too. And of course, you get unlimited access to all of the writing on slate.com. Please support us and all of our brilliant colleagues by going to slate.com/culture plus and signing up today. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. Okay, that was a lot of business. What's next, Steve?
Okay, well, Fire Island is a sandbar off the Long Island coast. It's made up of endless beaches dotted with little seaside cottages. It's also been a gay mecca since at least the 1930s. The new movie, Fire Island, is many things. It's an homage to that island's blend of hedonistic escape and romantic longing, as well as to the complex social politics within the gay community involving money and social class. It's also a love story modeled very sweetly and very archly on Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, as well as an attempt to redress the underrepresentation of gay Asian men across all media, not just the movies. There is so much to say about this deceptively small movie. It stars Bowen Yang and Margaret Cho, in addition to many, in a terrific ensemble cast. Why don't we listen to a clip? In the clip we're about to hear, the main character, Noah, who's played by Joel Kim Booster, is talking to his friend Howie, played by Bowen Yang. Howie's feeling a little disillusioned about Fire Island. Let's listen.
Coming here was a mistake. I can't believe you talked me into this again.
What the fuck are you talking about? You know the only time I see you now is on FaceTime?
No, I'm serious. We used to come here to be gay and stupid. And now I come here, I just feel terminally alone.
Alone? Look around. We're literally swimming in dick.
No, I don't mean like that. I mean like existentially lonely. And here in SF, never had a boyfriend.
Oh, God. Monogamy industrial complex rears its ugly head. Listen, I've never had a boyfriend either, and I'm fucking awesome.
Yeah, well, I'm not you.
Yeah, well, you could be. All you have to do is get laid once in a while.
Oh, fuck off.
No, I'm serious. I mean, why not? You're cute, you're funny, you're consistently the least repellent to men out of all of us. I mean, let me be your wingman. Everybody should fuck on Fire Island at least once. It's like our birthright.
All right, well, to discuss Fire Island, we're joined by E. Alex Jung of Vulture, the estimable culture site. Alex, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You wrote a wonderful, both critical and reported piece about the movie. It was terrific, and I hope people seek it out. There's a lot to say, but why don't we start here? This is a really, really good movie, in my estimation. I loved it. Can you describe Fire Island, the place, maybe a little bit in the history of sort of gay iconography? And then let's turn to the movie and whether or not, you know, the movie captures something of its essence.
Sure. I mean, I think, as you mentioned, it's been a kind of getaway for, you know, gay male New Yorkers since the 30s. And then I think, you know, with the post-Stonewall disco era, it became a real hedonistic party island. You know, it was a place where you could go and everywhere you would just be surrounded by other gay men. So I think what is really lovely about the movie is that it really captures that sort of spirit of, you know, what happens in Fire Island stays in Fire Island.
you say something I thought very interesting near the top of your piece, which is that you say, in as much as Fire Island is one of the first major studio gay rom-coms starring a queer cast, it's a film preoccupied with the inherent contradiction of gay liberation. The freedom of post-Stonewall sexuality is promised to some more than others. Talk about that and that specific aspect of the film, if you would.
Yeah. I mean, this movie was written by Joel Kim Booster, who I think is very perceptive of social dynamics and power dynamics in the world and also in the gay community particularly. And, you know, if you don't know much about him, he's a gay Korean adoptee who grew up in the Midwest to very evangelical parents. And I think that if you are a gay Asian American man, you will sort of inevitably be confronted with this feeling of diminishment. You know, and I think that is always present. And I think that is a constant negotiation. And so when you're in a place like Fire Island, that is supposed to be this kind of playground or utopia of gay sexuality and freedom and drugs and all of these things, you sort of realize that maybe you don't get to participate in this in the same way. And I think that clip that you even played, sort of highlights that difference for, you know, a character like Howie, who's played by Bowen, and how he experiences this place and whether or not he gets to just sort of be free as Joel's character Noah is.
Alex, and really all of you, I wonder if you had any thoughts about what this movie does with friendship. I think my favorite relationship in the movie is the one that is not romantic at all between, you know, what would be the equivalent of Lizzie Bennet and her sister Jane in Pride and Prejudice, which is, you know, the Bowen Yang character and Joel Kim Booster's main character, who is also, as you said, Alex, the screenwriter of the movie. And it seemed like this was something really unusual. Obviously, the portrait of the entire community and of Fire Island itself is somewhat unprecedented in a mainstream rom-com. But I love that there was a mainstream gay rom-com that has two best friends that are not romantically connected, don't seem to have ever been romantically connected. And yet, you know, I really think that their relationship and how it evolves is the heart of the movie.
I totally agree. You know, like I think my favorite scene was sort of the escalation of that argument or that conversation that we listened to just now, where they sort of tensions rise to the point of, I can't do this like you can, you know, and there was a real difference between how they experienced the world, which I thought was, I don't know, I've never seen that before, let alone any of this other stuff in a major movie.
Well, even the essence of what they're arguing about that we heard a bit of in that clip, right, which is sort of the value of what Joel Kim Booster's character regards as a heteronormatively framed relationship, right, this monogamous end of the movie happy ending love. The argument that they pursue throughout the movie about whether or not that is something of value and something that a human life or a romantic comedy should attain to is somewhat unusual within the framework of this genre.
I think that what is really interesting about what Joel did with Fire Island was that he could take a kind of classic rom-com trope and queer it and sort of make it feel right for him. And I think that includes his own tenuous relationship to monogamy and all of those things.
I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the rest of the ensemble and the dynamics and also some of the villains. I mean, I liked your language, deceptively small, Steve, because it's kind of an easy watch in a way. It's a snackable movie, but there are so many dynamics. There's a whole house full of multiple, like, evil, wealthy gay men who, or whatever, of varying degrees of fatuousness and jerkishness. And then there's the kind of crew of friends who's been going for years. And one of the things I really loved about the movie was the way it tracked the rhythm of a vacation and the sense you have of, like, it's endless, I'll never be back to reality. And then, oh no, time is ticking away. And am I taking, you know, the FOMO you can have for your own self and your own vacation and your own time. Like, I'm having so much fun. Am I having the right kind of fun in my special week of fun? Just the savviness about the desperate rhythms of relaxation, I thought was something really interesting and smart about it that I didn't feel like I'd seen in quite the same way. That sense of the fun time ticking. And then just the social comedy. And this is where the echoes of Jane Austen are particularly fun and pleasurable, of, you know, the detestably fancy neighbors. There's so much fun grist there. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that world sketching.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Fire Island is, like, when you go, it's a bit of a ticking time chair. You know, like you go on Thursday and you're like, I'm gonna make the most of this time, right? And so if you're a gay guy who's like, I don't know, so many people come who aren't from New York or aren't you know, like, living in the city. And so there might be even more pressure to, like, make the most of it and to have this kind of whatever this idea of a gay party would be. I think that element of pressure is, there's a highly sort of pressurized environment. And then, you know, obviously everyone's rolling up Molly or doing other drugs. And so there's this feeling that, like, maybe of magic too, where you can, like, suddenly meet someone and have this incredible romantic connection. But then also everyone is going to have to leave the bubble at some point, you know, there it ends. And then what happens after it ends? And I think Fire Island kind of smartly just exists within the bubble. It doesn't really try to, you know, you don't really get much backstory on any of the characters. You just sort of are living in the world and living in the dynamics of the world. And obviously because of, like, weird property laws, you, like, kind of can't, like, build anything more on the island. So, like, whatever land is there, which also means that people who have the really nice houses, you know, those people are there and they also look a certain part and they have the right house and real estate. It's interesting how well things map onto class dynamics like that.
Yeah, I mean, this is precisely what I loved most about this movie, which is that I was a heteronormie who used to visit the heteronormie end of Fire Island, where we rolled, you know, with gin and tonics and adultery instead. And what I love is, as in America, what everyone has in common is, you know, YIMBY versus NIMBY, depending on who actually owns the legacy real estate. That's universal. And this is what I kind of adored about the movie as much as anything, which is that this is the best reanimation to me of Jane Austen since Clueless, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason is just this flash of genius at the heart of it, which is that, well, what's Jane Austen about, right? It's about eligible bachelors, country houses, and the relationship of love to economic power. And the idea that it needs to be radically translated into the gay community on Fire Island is laughable. In fact, it was there all along and someone saw it. It's such a eureka. And then what I loved was also the execution, which is the movie comes at you in an opening blast, right? It introduces you to this ensemble with their bickering and their backstories. And I was like, okay, I'm a little overwhelmed, right? But then the way it settles into itself and the precision of its comedy and social awareness and its ability, its characters and its own ability to lapse into contemplative repose almost and melancholy, contrasting to the hedonism and the sense of the ticking timeshare. I really thought it was a beautifully realized film.
Yeah, I mean, I think I love that description, Steve. I think the other thing that was a revelation to me in this film is just Joel Kim Booster himself, who both has written something so precisely observed, as you say, Steve, but like really carries the, I mean, the whole ensemble is good, and the kind of the Bingleys and the Darcys are fun too, but it's an amazing performance, and he really, you know, as is the case with the meddlesome best friend who just wants to get their kindly pal laid, he has things to learn and things to ponder as well himself. And the performance is incredible. To talk a little bit more about Booster's career and where this lands in it, it feels to me like a pretty major thing to do pretty early on in a way that makes me really excited to see all that's to come.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I think that he had to write this movie in order to get to show off what he could do. You know, like nobody was going to make a movie, you know, even a generic movie about Fire Island or a gay rom-com about Fire Island and decide to cast him, right? He had to write a film that was, you know, rooted in his own experiences that he could then play. And I think that that's the luck of and persistence of his career is that he can finally do that, I guess. He started off mostly in stand-up. I think that's what he's known for. And he also, this is going to be a very big month for him because he has Psychosexual coming out on Netflix, which is a 1-hour special in a couple weeks, I think, or next week. So, and he has like a, you know, a co-starring role with Maya Rudolph in her Apple TV show Loot. So he's very much about to be present everywhere, I think. But I think that these things are just a kind of culmination of his, of what he's been working towards.
All right. Well, in addition to pointing people to the movie, which I think we all agree they should see if they haven't, I'd also like to point people to Alex's piece in Vulture. Went up on June 3rd. It's called Pride and Prejudice in Fire Island. Alex Jung, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was terrific, and I really hope we do it again soon.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you for having me.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I truly believe that everyone marries the wrong person. So goes the opening gambit of a very provocative opinion piece in the New York Times by Tish Harrison Warren. She goes on to say, if we as a culture view seeking personal fulfillment as a sacred duty, staying in an unhappy marriage is then seen as an act of self-betrayal. That's a characterization of the predominant attitude now towards marriage, unhappy marriage, and divorce. Regardless of what you make of her particular argument, some ways of betraying oneself also seem to resonate as a kind of social betrayal. So divorce wasn't, back in the old day, just the failure of a marriage. Divorce itself would be a social failure if divorces became widespread. Therefore, the individual bears some kind of burden, unfairly in my estimation, to the whole, to the social whole. Anyway, her observation, which I think is true, is now the logic of that has just been flipped entirely. It's now perceived as a kind of social betrayal not to pursue your own individual happiness to the max. Anyway, I found this extremely intriguing argument. Julia, what'd you make of it?
I felt that it was probably useful to some people for her to have written this piece, but it felt a little straw manny to me. Like, is there in fact a widespread culture that you have to divorce your partner as soon as you feel a moment's dissatisfaction? I don't know that there really is. I mean, I think she is talking about a real social phenomenon, which is that there is probably more of an assumption now than there was certainly 50 years ago that a bad marriage is worse than no marriage. And for, you know, centuries, that was impossible for women because women had, in many cultures, had very little way to be even a person in the world with property or money or means to feed them and clothe themselves and survive outside of a marriage. So it's a very new idea that you know, a marriage that isn't fulfilling is inherently a bad one. And it's probably worth pointing that out. But this piece suggested, I don't know, a level of oppressiveness of that idea that felt slightly overstated to me. And I think we were interested in talking about it along with some other recent essays in which people write very publicly about their dissatisfactions with their partners and what it is to write about love and marriage for a public audience, like that, it, you know, what we make of those essays. There is something that is brave about it, because it puts the reader, including me, in the position of thinking like, well, I don't know. That does sound like a tough marriage. Are you sure? Are you sure? Are you sure you want to stay married? That seems like a big slog. Which is, of course, the whole point, is that she's finding the growth that is coming with her particular slog rewarding. So it seemed like a useful counterpoint, but perhaps one that slightly overstated the prevalence of the everybody get divorced idea somehow. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I don't love this kind of piece. This kind of, for one thing, it's so short, right? And what she reveals is so selective and calculated that I don't really feel like I know the background of why these two people aren't happy together and how I should apply that to my life or to life in general. And I don't know. I feel like there's something about this kind of performative, my relationship is great kind of piece, which ultimately is what this is, even if she's saying all these quite harsh things about the suffering that she and her husband have gone through in the last 17 years. There's still something a little bit sanctimonious about the way that she's holding up this portrait of this particular relationship as you say, Julia, a model of what marriage should be or some kind of instructive bit of morality. I mean, she says some things that don't apply to every normal couple's bit of unhappiness in their lives. For example, that the pastor who counseled them before they were going to get married said that they should not get married, and that her husband himself, who is an Anglican priest, would not have counseled a couple who had the disagreements that they had when they got married to get married. She has a sentence that to me seems alarming. One paragraph begins, "The last 17 years have held long stretches where one or both of us was deeply unhappy. There have been times when contempt settled on our relationship, caked and hard as dried mud." contempt is actually a specific emotion that I've seen cited before in studies as something that relationships can't survive. You know, that if one member of a couple feels contempt for the other, really feels like they're sort of unworthy to be in the relationship, that it's very hard for that relationship to survive. I have no idea if that applies to these two people, but I mean, there's some stuff in this article that does have a little bit of the tone of, I mean, she says right out, we only stayed married for some years for the sake of our children and because of, you know, our religious beliefs. So that doesn't seem like something that can be applied across the board to everyone to make, as you were saying, Julia, some larger sociological point about marriage. So I don't know. I mean, these kind of pieces almost never make me come away thinking, oh, I see my own life or relationship in a different way. It's a little bit more like, well, sucks for you, lady, but I don't know what conclusion I'm supposed to draw from it.
So here are the two aspects that interested me most. One is that, you know, well, what's the superego at work in any given age, you know, sort of at the social superego? And, you know, in, for example, my mother's generation, it was owing this, I think, horrendously burdensome fealty to the nuclear ideal of, you know, sort of, I mean, many, many aspects of it that are just screamingly anachronistic now, the male, you know, breadwinner and the, you know, female homemaker and the just the gender division of labor and on and on and on. But what I like about this piece is it points to what the possible new cultural superego is. And you could argue, if you wanted to be a little, you know, nerdy about it, sort of under neoliberalism, which is that the fealty that you owe is so internalized. It really is to your best self, this construct that turns into, right? It's like supposed to be liberating. You move toward this ideal, you owe something to that ideal, but it's actually, it has this structure of a very burdensome superego for many people. And it's, you know, it's beset by the paradox of choice in the age of the internet. When one is single, you know, you're on the internet and you're just constantly shopping across, you know, space and time, which are unconstraining now, to discover the exactly right person for you. And so in a sense, I liked the rhetorical extremity of it. I think what I found interesting about it that I believe the author is not accounting for enough is, you know, that strange, really dark wisdom of the Frost poem, Road Not Taken, which is what he says about that road, is that one day I will justify my choice as if it were the courageous one, whichever road I take. And that's this incredible act of like proleptic understanding. I know that I'll be this sententious fool 10, 20, 30, 40 years hence, who will inevitably take the same consolation that others do. And as corrosive as regret is, this is like, it's non-corrosive, it's very solacing, but it's could be even more false in some elemental way than regret. I mean, she's telling herself, my choice was the right choice, in exactly the way the speaker of the Frost poem says, one day I'm going to do this, but don't believe me then. It's nonsense.
Totally. I mean, the piece, I think, has some interesting studies in it that show that for people who are unhappy, divorce didn't increase their happiness. And that's really interesting. And, you know, I'm sure we all feel fortunate to be people who have not gotten divorced. And I'm sure we all know people who've gotten divorced or who've considered getting divorced and have not gotten divorced. And it's super hard to do, you know, even if when it is the right thing to do. It's really disruptive and it's really confusing and it's really destabilizing. And I mean, it makes sense that it's not a step to take lightly. But again, that's what sort of felt strawman-y to me about it. Like, it is true that there is a broader cultural be your best self imperative. I think that is the most interesting idea here. But it's not actually like everyone is going around being like, oh yeah, divorce, what a breeze. Nobody minds. The kids are fine. Like, yeah, it's really, it is a big deal, even if it's on the table in a way that it wasn't before. So that's what sort of feels circular about the piece somehow. Mm. I'm curious what your response is to people writing in a revealing way about marriages that they are in with living people, and also whether you can think of examples of writing about marriages that you are in with a living person that you really loved and responded to and thought were wise and profound and didn't seem like a concatenation of facts intended to fill out an op-ed?
I mean, the first thing that came to mind, and this is, I haven't read this book, so I can't say which side it falls on, but I'm just thinking of that Heather Havrilesky book that came out earlier this year. It's called Foreverland, and it's essentially, I mean, I get the impression that it's almost more of a humor book in a way, although I'm sure it also has some self-revelatory stuff in it, but it's the subtitle of Foreverland is On the Divine Tedium of Marriage, and I know from, you know, the response in the press at the time, like the View ladies were scandalized by it. It got a pretty negative review in the Times from someone who, you know, regarded it as sort of posturing. I mean, but Heather Havrilesky, I think, went really far, and that's the kind of writer she is. You know, she's a very self-disclosing writer in exposing her husband's putative faults, and her own too, I'm sure. But, you know, there were the comparisons of her husband to a smelly pile of laundry, and essentially sort of like the worst kind of domestic metaphors. It almost seemed like very edgy Irma Bombeck columns or something like that. And people were really upset about it. I have no opinion about that book per se, but the fact that it created that outcry made me think about this. And I really think in general that I'm pretty turned off by this kind of writing. Like, I almost never like the modern love column for the Times. It almost always, to me, has that slight scent of smugness, you know, of like Steve with the road not followed. Whatever road I followed is the right road, and therefore implied the road that you too should follow. So, I mean, I wish I could say, give some counterexample of a person who writes incredibly about marriage and family life. I think maybe with writing about one's children, it's a little bit easier than writing about an intimate partnership that's still going on. But it feels really hard for that not to be a betrayal, you know. And I personally would, I can't imagine a circumstance in which I would write unflattering things about my partner for publication while still hoping to have a successful relationship with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is often a posture when people do it that's like, my marriage is, I mean, whatever, it's always smug. There's no way to do it that's not smug, because it's either like unctuous, like my partner and I love each other so much, or it's like, my marriage is so tough and we're so honest and real that like I can just tell you about the laundry pile and you deluded sheep can't handle it, like how honest my marriage is. And part of the compulsion of reading is like, they really seem like they're about to get divorced, or maybe not. I don't know. Maybe their marriage is on some astral plane. But it's all fundamentally performance. And I guess I just feel sort of old fashioned and square, like, or fundamentally more a partner than an artist or something. Like, mm-hmm. It's a private, special thing. I don't want to write about it. And I sort of distrust the impulse to write about it in others in a way that's probably not fair to them and to the multiplicity of human experience. But
I want to hear, I hope listeners who have counterexamples of, you know, well, no, here is a great revelatory essay or book about a marriage that's still ongoing and in some way successful, that they'd point us to it. Because I'm sure it's out there. Obviously, it's part of human experience that can be written about well.
You gave me the greatest one of all time, maybe. James Joyce and Nora Barnacle. Right? I mean, it's from whence we get, you know, both Stephen Dedalus's and Bloom's relationship to Molly Bloom, right? I mean, like, and I mean, she is Molly Bloom, right? In Joyce's mind, she was, maybe not in reality or Nora Barnacle's, but...
Well, if something's sublimated into a fictional character, though, does it count, I wonder? I mean, certainly, I'm sure there are people who have had successful relationships that have subsumed them into literature, but that's not the same as James Joyce saying, let me tell you about Nora and all her faults, you know?
Man, Nora before coffee. Oof.
Well, we definitely get her after coffee in that last chapter of Ulysses. Bada bing. But all right, this is one that listener mail will be just a very rich vein, I'm sure. But all right, shoot us some text. Let's move on. All right. Well, now is the moment in the podcast where we endorse. Dana, what'd you bring in this week?
Steve, my endorsement this week is in honor of the late actor Philip Baker Hall, who the announcement of his death just came out the day before we taped, and he was 90 years old, so he had a good long life and a very long career as a character actor. Whether or not you recognize the name Philip Baker Hall, I guarantee you will recognize his face and his voice. He's completely one of those It's That Guy character actors of the late 20th century who was in every other thing you can think of, from, you know, Seinfeld to Paul Thomas Anderson's debut feature Hard Eight to, oh my goodness, he had his own sitcom, I believe. People are going to write in and tell me other Philip Baker Hall cameos that they can think of, but he really was one of the great character actors of his generation. And last night, in his honor, I went back and rewatched Secret Honor, which is, Steve, you would be fascinated by this, I think, a 1984 Robert Altman film that's a one-man show. It's based on a play with one character, which is Richard Nixon in his late years. It's Richard Nixon post-Watergate, basically getting drunk on his own in his study and kind of ranting into a tape recorder. Are you familiar with either the movie, the play, the concept of Secret Honor?
None of the above, and I'm going to run, not walk. This sounds so cool.
It's such a bizarre curiosity. I mean, in some ways, it doesn't entirely work. The performance is fantastic. The reason to watch it is because Philip Baker Hall as Nixon is just extraordinary. And the script is really good. But it feels strangely theatrical and enclosed. The music doesn't really go with the action. There's something a little bit off about it and maybe a bit dated, but it's so such a strange oddity and so worth watching for his performance. And also, I was thinking strangely timely in the same week that we're watching, or I'm anyway, riveted to the hearings about January 6th and the late kind of Mad King days of the Trump administration. So in many different ways, a lot of things converge to make Secret Honor the watch of my week. And I should also mention, it's streaming all over the place, but if you watch it on the Criterion Channel, the extras are incredible. I'm still in the midst of the extras, but there's a commentary track with Robert Altman talking through the movie, which is great. And I haven't watched this yet, but there's also a little interview with Philip Baker Hall about playing Richard Nixon. So there's a whole package on Criterion if you watch it there. And if not, you can find it streaming on lots of other platforms. Secret Honor from 1984.
That's just amazing. Julia, what do you have?
All right. Well, I think it's only fair that in a week when I primly complained that nobody should ever write about their marriage, and in which I eagerly wait to be proven wrong by all of our listeners telling us about great essays about marriages, that I reveal something slightly personal for my endorsement. I want to recommend today, I don't know even what to call it or if it has a name, but micro journaling maybe is the name. I purchased, I think, both from Amazon, which feels like a sad place to purchase so intimate a tool. Two things, one called the 5-Minute Journal and one called One Line a Day. And each of them has like different little formats that basically ask you to, the 5-Minute Journal has you like write a little bit in the morning and write a little bit in the evening. And it's like a little more self-helpy maybe. But the One Line a Day, I think, is really fun, and I think our listeners would enjoy. It basically just has you write one sentence a day and gives you like enough space for it that you can kind of get creative with your dependent clauses and your semicolons if you want to, or you can just do something very short and declarative. And it feels more like a little teeny tiny daily writing exercise than the other one, which is, as I said, a little bit more like self-helpy and me going full California. But I think there's just something about the oddness of a life that has you sitting at a computer all the time, as mine does, and the feeling of time passing that just has made me want to have a little bit of a recording impulse. I think maybe since my father died, I started doing both of these. But it's really hard to figure out how to do it. I've never really been a diarist or a journal keeper. I'm so much more fluent as a typist than I am in handwriting. Like, I really find it hard to express anything fluently in longhand. It's like speaking another language. Like, my hands just can't keep up with my brain. And so it's very frustrating. But then the thought of trying to keep, like, a typed journal is really... I think I spend all fucking day typing things, and I do not feel in a contemplative space when I'm looking at a screen. And so I just the notion of like, okay, I can write one sentence in longhand today. And actually, it's really fun to write a sentence and play with all the different structures and formats that a sentence can take. And then you end up with this like interesting little record of the tiny textures of your days. I'm really enjoying it. So One Line a Day and the 5-Minute Journal.
I like that. I wrote down One Line a Day.
All right. Well, in the spirit of brevity, I'm going to do a couple of songs that I've been listening to lately. I love the phenomenon of the cover, of course. Everyone loves a good cover song. You know, an artist appropriating but away from the original version, but also honoring it is pretty cool. The best is, to me, to my mind, is just taking like a song that's got virtues that have been overloaded with either false sentiment or bad production values, or I don't know, they're just too lachrymose or cloying. They're just turned into something that kind of ruins what might have been the heart of the song. There's a great version by Leo Nocentelli, who of the Meters, of the old Elton John slightly lachrymose song, Your Song, which was, I believe, Elton John's first big radio hit. And he just kills it. I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind what I put down in words. How wonderful life is while you're in the world. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He just turns it into such a great, great song. And then this is not a cover, but it's just what's been absolutely slaying me lately. It is such the band The Apartments is the most underrated indie rock band of all time. The lead guy was in the Go-Betweens for a little while, but he was like too downbeat even for them. That's an oversimplification, but he moved on to do his own thing. He's still going, and I just, people should really give it a try. He just, you know, anyway, he has a song that I wasn't familiar with, and there's a great live version of it called Live at Lubu is the album, L apostrophe UBU, because of course the French understand this man's genius. And it's called Everything is Given to be Taken Away. Ba, 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 ba. I don't know, it's just the dreamy, melancholy, poppy, in both the sense of pop song and like the flower that you walk through and become dizzy and sleepy. You know, it's just so seductive. It's a great song, check it out. Julia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dana, thank you. This was fun. Really fun.
It was a pleasure.
Yep. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by Nicholas Bertel. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.